This is Mental, the podcast that destigmatizes mental health. I'm Bobby Timms.
I'm Annie Harris.
Each Thursday, we delve into a factor or condition that influences the mind and how to better manage it. With special guests and stats you can trust, here we go. This week, we're talking all about psychiatry. And to start off with, we have a few stats. So from the House of Commons Library, they found that 1 million people were in contact with adult mental health services as of December 2017. So, of course, not all of those million people will be psychiatrists, but this hopefully shows the scale of how many people are supported by mental health professionals like this. So, Annie, does that stat surprise you at all?
I am not surprised in the slightest. I am very pleased, however, and proud to announce that Population Pocket Corner, whatever we're going to call it, has come back. Population Corner. What did I call it? Population... bugger. I can't remember.
I don't remember.
The population of Dallas, Texas is just over 1 million people. So we've gone across the pond this time. UK cities by population... Look.
Well, Birmingham is just over 1 million.
Yeah, Birmingham's just over 1 million. I'm so excited the Population Pocket's back. All jokes aside, that is totally mad. But I'm just so chuffed that I get to be part of something that highlights that and raises the awareness, I guess, like without sounding really simple.
Yeah, I get what you mean.
That we're still really pushing this point home, is what I mean.
Yeah, well, again, it's like we talk about in the episode with this week's guest. It's just highlighting how common mental illness is, how completely normal it is in certain situations. I kind of have mixed feelings about this stat because on one hand, I'm not surprised by it when it's 1 million people compared to nearly 70 million people in the population. I'm not surprised that there's that many, particularly when you think about the 1 in 4 people will be affected by mental health each year, according to Mind. However, on the other side, it makes me think about all the people that aren't being supported, because for that million, there's actually far more who aren't being supported currently by adult mental health services than are, based on that.
Yeah. We've talked about this quite a lot on the podcast before, haven't we? Like, it's very important to consider that these are just the people that are being, and also these are people just being recorded as being, as using mental health services as well. So the amount of people that are actually using mental health services or missing out on mental health services in total must be absolutely staggering.
Yeah, so I mean, that's good and bad, because on one hand, this is a statistic from the House of Commons, so they may not have as much access to charity data in terms of where that support is being given. This will be specifically things like the NHS that are state funded. However, at the same time, it does make me, like yourself, proud to be doing the work we're doing, in that we're providing kind of content and hopefully increasing understanding amongst all the people that aren't getting the active support. I'm well aware that for many listeners, this may be the one exposure to mental health information in their week.
Yeah, that's absolutely insane. Oh, God.
So
I don't have anything to add to that. Like, you summed it up really consistently.
Cool, I'm glad. Well, we'll move right along. So next, we've got some information from the Royal College of Psychiatrists. They said, the UK needs more psychiatrists, and the Royal College of Psychiatrists is currently undertaking a campaign to make this happen. There is an ongoing rise in the report number of vacancies or unfilled consultant posts across the UK. So that is up from 5% in 2013 to 9% in 2017. So that's quite a lot of information, but basically what they're saying is that the number of vacant or unfilled posts for psychiatry has nearly doubled between 2013 and 2017. How do you feel about that?
That's so nuts. Like, is that a case of like people being under more stress and needing to access these sorts of services? Or is that a case of people being more open and more aware and less ashamed of seeking help? Like, it's a double-edged sword, really. I'm sure it's a bit from column A and a bit from column B. It's not going to be all like one way or t'other that it's grown so much in the last few years. But I think maybe in the part that people need it more these days, it's also in part that people are more comfortable asking for the support these days because of projects like ours.
Yeah, it's a difficult one. Like you said, it's going to be a whole range of factors. Interestingly, the Royal College of Psychiatrists haven't offered any answer when I've looked into it further on why this increase in vacancies has taken place. But it does remind me of something we talk about in the interview a little bit, in that the guest faced a bit of pressure from her own family to go into a specialty not mental health related. So originally she was keen on surgery, and her family were more keen on the idea of that than something mental health related. So I wonder if that kind of...
Does that ring any bells, Bobs?
I wonder if that particular type of specific medical stigma plays a part.
Yeah, perhaps.
That's something that I was quite keen to touch on, definitely. Yeah. The kind of split, even within the medical world, of how there's that mental health and physical health separation, and the understanding doesn't always cross over, given that no matter what profession you're doing, in medicine, it's impossible for you to just deal with one. There's no physical illness you could possibly be treating where there's not going to be a mental health.
Yeah, I suppose factor. So. That's really interesting. Or like how that living with that physical illness makes them feel. I think that's a big part of recovery. It's like taking note of the patient's mental health as well as their physical health.
Absolutely. It's impossible to just treat one. And yes, there are patients that are only going to need the support in one, but there's no profession I can think of where there's not going to be factors from the other side that come into it. That's why it's so important that there's understanding, whether you are, if you're in the NHS or any other kind of physical health support, you have to have the understanding of mental health, because they're very much a part of the same story. And so, yeah, that's what I've got to say on that.
And good then, for you. No, it's super concise. Thank you. I was just jotting something down, like just thinking of mental plans, planning for the future. I can't wait to bring super exciting things to our listeners. I'm so excited. Sorry, I'm just making noises because I'm doodling. This is my doodling noise. Okay. It's the end of the day. Can you tell?
I can definitely tell. So what kind of things are you excited about?
I'm like excited about like how, well, first of all, I'm thinking about like how excited I am that the podcast has grown so much, but also like thinking about, and like, you don't have to put this in if you absolutely don't want to, but like, I'm thinking quite a lot about like how, what amazing work we've done so far. And like the message that we have is that we want to raise awareness and sort of break down the stigma around mental health. But I think like, I really would be so interested in like assessing or like figuring out how we can assess what we have, well, the impact that we have made so far. Like, how can we quantify that and give that to our listeners and say, like, this is what your listening has done, you know, like, what have we achieved in a year? Like, I'm just thinking about that when you were talking. I was like, because we're always, obviously, I say the word banging on, we're always banging on about like breaking down stigma, because obviously that's super important. Like, that's why I don't think banging on is like quite the right phrase that I want to use. But we're always going on about it, and they're like, okay, now what? Like, what has our banging on achieved? You know, like, what have we created together with like our listener community, and how have we broken down stigma? So, like, that's why I'm so excited for the future, because like the amount that this podcast is just like growing so excitingly, and how much people are getting out of it, just makes me feel so like warm and fuzzy on the inside. I'm just like, I love like reading everyone's reviews and like seeing what people have said and like the impact that we're having. So yeah, just dreaming big, Bob, dreaming big.
And nice way to drop in that we appreciate reviews there. So
oh yeah, by the way, I just love reading them 5-star reviews, you know what I'm saying?
But no, it is so important to us, and it really brings it back when we get listeners email in and share their thoughts or their experiences, the podcast has impacted their life or made them feel more comfortable talking about mental health. That's what we're here for, and so that really helps it feel like we're not shouting out into the void, that there's a clear cause and effect of making a difference here. And you know, we're lucky to have things like the petition, where the listeners have been so brilliant in bringing that to 191,000 signatures, I think, now. And we've just entered for several British Podcast Awards, and I'm delighted that we can add that all in. We can show, here's what the listeners are saying, here's the petition and how much they've supported it, here's the wonderful reviews we get. There's
yes,
it's wonderful to see that link and see that not only are we making a difference, but it's growing and we're reaching more and more people, because after all, we're here to destigmatize mental health for as many people as possible.
Mm-hmm. Oh, feels good, fam. Feels good.
All right. So there's one last, while we're all feeling good, there's one last statistic I wanted to bring in, which is actually a callback from our episode of politics as a factor in mental health. And so this statistic is from the BBC, and they looked at how mental health funding differs in terms of amount of activity and the NHS budget. So the difference was 23% total NHS activity relating to mental health versus 11% was the NHS budget for mental health activity. Previously, when we mentioned that statistic, it was from the angle of this is why that more funding is needed. There's more than double the activity going on versus the amount of funding they're receiving respectively to other kinds to other types of support. And so that was a really clear example of here's the need for better resources. Here's the need for the government to pay out more to the NHS to support mental health in its patients. So
absolutely,
I thought this was a relevant one to bring back today on a slightly more positive angle, because we're speaking to a mental health professional who works in the NHS, in that isn't it incredible that although they need more funding, that that's going on, that these doctors are going above and beyond the funding that's allocated to provide far more care than you'd think is possible. And I think that's really a sign of the strength of our NHS and the commitment of the professionals within it.
Awesome. Yeah. Oh, that's so good. So, I love our NHS. Like, we're so lucky. Like, I can't, but like, we're so, so lucky. Like, for all of its faults, we are extremely lucky.
We really are. And so that segues nicely into talking about the guest, because we talk about the NHS quite a lot. She's a psychiatrist currently working in London. She's incredibly insightful. She's been on podcasts before, so she knows the scene. She's very quotable. And I'm delighted to have got the chance to talk to her. So she goes by the secret psychiatrist to help kind of keep that appropriate distance when it comes to like the patients and the work that she does out there on the online world, blogging and on Twitter. We are going to link her Twitter in the episode description. It's definitely worth a follow. And yeah, I hope you enjoy this wonderfully insightful episode. And I've saved up personally a lot of questions about psychiatry. And so we talk a lot about pill shaming. We talk about how ethnic minorities can be affected by stigma in different ways. We talk about loads of different factors that go into some of the challenges, but also some of the triumphs she has in her job. So anything else you want to say before we head into that interview, Annie?
No, I'm so excited, and I'm just sorry I wasn't there to listen to it. I'm super excited to listen to it now, though.
Cool. She's an absolute delight. And
yay! Yeah. I love delights.
And listeners, if you do enjoy this interview, do be vocal about it. I've already got quite a few ideas for other topics we could cover with this guest. So if you like the episode, let us know and we can have her back. And we'll get into that interview with the secret psychiatrist in a moment. But first, who's our sponsor? Let's find out.
Hi, I'm the secret psychiatrist. I'm a female doctor working in psychiatry currently in London, have been for more years than I like to actually say. It's strange, I kind of fell into psychiatry quite literally, and I don't know if I believe in fate or destiny, but in this case, I do think it was. So growing up, you know, when you're 17, you have to decide what you want to do when you're older. So I decided I wanted to be three things, which was slightly ambitious. So I wanted to be a writer, an actor, and a doctor. So I remember it being quite an emotional time, being about 17, 18, because I'm British Asian and my parents just did not understand what that meant. And they were saying, you know, you have to pick one career. What are you on about? You can't do three things. And I was like, no, I'm going to do that. So I decided to go to medical school first, but I didn't know at that time what kind of doctor I wanted to be. And medical schools really bizarre because you do 6 years of training and you do kind of everything and anything, but also you just touch on the surface, so you don't get a real sort of depth of things. So psychiatry actually never even hit my head, actually. I was really passionate about surgery, which I never thought I would be. So when I eventually actually graduated from medical school, I had to decide what kind of doctor I wanted to be. And I thought I'd go into surgery, so that's what I was gearing into. And I don't know about fate, but again, I just think it must be because I met who's now a consultant psychiatrist, and I was in Cambridge at the time, and he actually came to me, who I just happened to work with very briefly, and said he thought I'd be an excellent psychiatrist. And it never even popped into my mind. I didn't actually like it in medical school. So I thought, you know, this is a really weird suggestion he's making, especially to someone. If anyone's met a surgeon and you say that to someone who's a budding surgeon, that's a really weird thing to say. You know, you wouldn't be good at surgery. You'd be good at talking to people. So I was like, oh, this is really strange. But I actually did take what he said on board, and I kind of reflected back on the last sort of 10 years. And at that time, I was about 24 years old. And I'd looked back and I thought, actually, were all the signs there? Because before going to medical school, I did a lot of charity work, actually with those with autism and learning disability. And it was just something that I'd always done since a little girl. And that obviously, for those that know, falls under sort of the mental health speciality of medicine.
I just wanted to pause on what you said there about your parents and coming from that Asian background, because for me, coming from an Irish background, I had a similar experience with my parents, where they had a lot of pressure on them to go into a role with a title. You know, having left Ireland, there was this expectation that you've got to go and you've got to get a certain kind of job. And so you can imagine fast forwarding now, trying to explain that I have a podcast.
What is this?
It is really quite alien to them and completely outside of the kind of medicine arena they would have quite liked me to go into. And so your parents then were, I'm assuming, really happy with you going off and studying medicine. Did they have a sort of preference on what kind of medicine you went into?
No. So, I mean, I think the main thing they wanted was me to get a really strong education. That was really important to them. And I think also that's a culture thing. I completely agree with you. But they had no preference. But it was really funny because, you know, of all the people, my mum actually didn't get a degree. My dad's a lawyer. So you would think stereotypically my dad would be pushing me to, for example, go into surgery, but it was actually my mom. So when I actually told her I really love surgery and I want to go into surgery, she was actually so excited about it. Whereas my dad was just like, you know, do whatever makes you happy. You know, he didn't really care. And he was just like, you know, because he knows like what hard work is and he wants you to go in and enjoy it. And then, which of course my mum does as well. But when I decided, when I met that consultant, to go in psychiatry, they both were really taken aback, but in different ways. So with my mum, and I think every parent has this, don't they? On some level, they want to, my child does this, or, you know, my child got a certificate of this or whatever. I think it's that kind of thing they have. So my mum was very worried about me going to mental health, and also because there was a lot of stigma and I've having to educate my family on mental health. So my mum had that stereotypical image some people do of mental health, that it's dangerous and really risky and I'll get hurt. And she was really concerned for my welfare because, you know, unfortunately that's what's portrayed in lots of films. And, you know, she had watched, you know, Flying of the Cuckoo's Nest. And when I told her, you know, I get to do ECT, she just, you know, in her head, she was saying, you're going to electrocute people. And, you know, because that's all she understands of mental health and that's all she knew of it. Whereas my dad took a different way, but again it was very stigmatized in that way he looked at it. And it's because they, you know, they're not exposed to it. They said, oh, you're going into a job where it's all about drugs. And I kind of, in a way, like, I'm not embarrassed of their opinion because it's so common. I found it quite refreshing that my parents said it to me quite directly, because myself, I didn't know a lot about mental health either. I just found it so fascinating. And that's from the history of psychiatry, because I feel like it's the origin of medicine, actually, you know, with Hippocrates and Socrates and Freud. So that's what interested me. And I didn't know what you really do day to day. And actually, when I spoke to loads of my friends who are doctors and surgeons, they actually also have the stereotypical view, because you don't get enough exposure in medical school of psychiatry. You get about 2 weeks, if that. And that's why the curriculum in, you know, especially in the UK, they're really hot on it now. So they're taking mental health very seriously in medical school because medical students don't know about it. We're not educated about it, even if you do medicine. So I think I had to deal with that kind of stigma with my parents, but in a very positive way, I think. And since actually choosing to do psychiatry, I can't even express to you, it's really bizarre because my family is Asian, so they're Sikh with some Christianity as well. Mm-hmm. And mental health was never discussed as a family. You know, we were very, I mean, you know, my family is born in Britain, but no one spoke about it. And as soon as I became a psychiatrist, oh my gosh, it was like worms coming out the ground. I don't think there's a single family member that hasn't spoken about some sort of mental health problems that either they've gone through or someone they know. And it's really opened up communication, good and bad. I mean, you know, communication is not always easy, but with everybody. And it's really incredible to see that slightly opening that door of me just entering mental health, people have felt comfortable in my family talk about it.
I have something similar as well, having the podcast, that so many people in my life now talk to me about this. And I'm even most of my friends go to person for mental health conversation. Something about working in that field and showing up for mental health, suddenly people are like, oh, they're a safe space. I'm not going to find stigma there.
No, I completely agree with you. I think that's what it is. I think people feel like almost it's like you're holding a little white flag and that you're sort of a safe island to go to, which I think is excellent. And I mean, you said, like, did you have that stigma initially then with your family?
So I think the stigma is different, but very similar in Ireland. I think one of the main differences I notice is the kind of man up culture is so much bigger. And it's not just for men. There's a kind of, like, I guess the English equivalent is that stiff upper lip, like, keep calm and carry on. In Ireland, there's a very similar thing. And I think that's a big part why so often we're overrepresented in alcoholism and other conditions that are used as escapism from your issues. And so I'm sort of very aware of that. So while my parents are in medicine and are therefore more clued in because of it, I think my broader family still hold a lot of mental health stigma. But even within the medical field, I feel like there's a massive split, because I think even my parents, they're both, they do a number of things, but they're both hospital based for some of the time. But I think they over anticipate how much mental health problems they deal with, because there's always people like yourself who support that kind of care. And so actually they're maybe not as exposed to it and as good at dealing with it as they perhaps perceive.
No, it's really interesting that you said even within medicines there's a split, because that's really true. So actually I remember speaking about this a while ago. There's actually a split with doctors. It's really interesting. So I will get referred patients. I mean, for example, I had a patient that had a GCS of 3. What that means is essentially you're almost like a cabbage. Essentially you need emergency help. You know, someone's not walking, talking, moving, and they're not reacting. So it's very, very, you know, it's high risk. And I was very cross because a doctor had referred this patient to me and in an ambulance. And I was just looking at this patient, you know, I was doing my emergency, as any doctors that are listening know, we call it the ABCDE. Mm-hmm. So it's when you basically assess breathing all the way throughout sort of the body systems quite quickly to get an emergency plan. And essentially, obviously, I had to say this patient needs to go to emergency services, what we call A&E in the UK. And I had to fight for that. And I just thought, why? And it was because, you know, and unfortunately, this happens because staff who don't know much about mental health, and just because you're a doctor and who haven't specialized in mental health, you actually don't know much about it. Mm-hmm. They just said, oh, it's just personality. You know, this person's got a personality disorder. So unfortunately, some people do see that label. And as soon as that happens, they just put everything on the mental health instead of thinking, actually, it doesn't mean you can't get, I don't know, a chest infection, a stroke, a heart attack. And therefore, those symptoms are actually to do with the physical health, rather than, you know, purely something else is going on, and they're intertwined. So you have to fight very hard as a psychiatrist, actually. And you get a lot of those sort of cases, and it's very, very difficult, even amongst the doctors. So there's this, I mean, we make a joke of it because you have to joke about it, otherwise you would cry every day. But, you know, amongst doctors, it's the surgeons that think they're the gods, essentially. And then right at the bottom, you make fun of the lab doctors, you know, the microbiologists and the psychiatrists, because they feel like they don't do anything. It's a common thing that you have, you know, it's like if you go to high school and you have, I don't know, you know, you have the goths and you have whatever, you kind of have that within the doctors as well. And that stigma is still very much there. And that's not really shaking, which people, you know, you don't think that would happen, do you? But it does happen.
Yeah, I think I'm aware of it partly with like surgeons as an example, that kind of hierarchy that they feel we're in operating theatres saving people's lives. But then equally, you giving someone the best care is saving their life. It could prevent a suicide attempt. And I don't really see why that's any different.
No, I don't. And I always say, without your mind, what are you? Just as without your body, what are you? You need both. And that's what, I mean, I'm very strong about that. And I always say they're both the same, just as you would treat your physical health exactly the same with mental health. And they actually, it shouldn't even be separated, I feel, by mental health or physical health. It should be all one. It should be physical and mental health, like all in one sentence. Because, you know, mental health affects your physical, just as the other way around. But I think amongst the community, it's slowly changing. There's more campaigns going on. I've just been to Westminster a few times. We're looking at social media and helping to sort of destigmatize that amongst young people. I mean, it's happening, but very, very slowly. And you would think in 2019, it would be much quicker, but unfortunately, it's just going very slowly.
Yeah. And if we could drill into like one particular example, because as an outsider to the NHS, I only know so much. Let's say, for example, someone was regularly in and out of A&E with a drinking problem, and it caused them injury or caused them to be sick to the extent they need to be taken in an ambulance. Obviously, you work in London. Is there a set procedure where you work for how that would potentially be referred to mental health teams, as well as just being seen as a physical problem that we need to tackle?
So firstly, alcohol problems, anything alcohol related, take up about 70% of all emergency referrals. It's quite a lot, actually. It takes up a lot of service time in A&E, those that go for emergency treatment, which people don't know, it's actually a very big problem. Yeah. If someone's coming in and out, the first thing that you have to do is you have to deal with, you know, whatever physical symptoms are happening right now. That's number one. You have to deal with that. So, you know, the medics will get involved there. So the medical doctors, and make sure they're stable. Then they can actually, from say, if you just went to A&E, so you went to the emergency services, you popped in or whatever for that emergency or acute situation, you can get a referral. So you can, you know, the doctors there, the nurses there can make a referral to what we normally do, addiction services in that point, right, for alcohol addiction. And that can be either via your GP, so your family doctor, or it can be done via the hospital. It's quite rare that you would see a psychiatrist then and there, unless there's another comorbidity. And what I mean by that, there's depression, suicidal ideas, anxiety, to a point of you might need admission then and there.
Right. So if it was severe enough that the mental health side presents a emergency in and of itself, is that right?
Yeah. Okay. So that would be one thing. You can get a referral for, not then and there, but you can get the referral done for someone in the community to see you within the next week or so for mental health side. So you can get a referral that way, but I would recommend to do it by the GP, actually, because then they'll be the port of call if anything happens. And usually the GP has lots of different services within their own practice that they can refer you to. They might have their own psychiatrist, they might have their own liaison mental health nurse there, or a service within their service, basically, for alcohol.
Okay, that's really interesting. And part of the reason I am a bit biased in bringing up that kind of example, because as a non-drinker myself, I see how much strain is placed on the NHS from drinking, binge drinking, addiction. And so it's really good to hear that there are those structures in place to get at least a referral immediately from A&E, even if the support isn't there immediately.
Yeah, but the biggest, unfortunately, one has to remember in these situations, most of the time, actually, patients don't want the referral. So you have to take that into account. Even though it takes up a large of the resources, we can't force, unless there's a capacity issue or mental health pressing acutely right now, we can't force people to participate in services. And most of the time, that's one of the biggest challenges, actually, is for them to even want the help.
Yeah, and I can imagine that must be so frustrating for the A&E teams when they're starting to recognise some of the faces that don't accept the support.
Yeah, no, it's really frustrating. I mean, it's frustrating for me as well. It's frustrating for everyone because, you know, we do actually want something to happen. Like, we want to help, and we feel like our hands are tied because we have someone clearly needing help, and then we can only get so far, but then we can't sort of finish the job in a way. And it's really frustrating because it's like a half job, half done, you know, and we know they'll be back and they'll need more help. And usually every time it gets worse. And if we can just sort of nip it in the bud then and there, I mean, it's an incredible feeling when you can help someone through that journey, but it's so infuriating, especially when you have, and even simple things like DNA, I have so many patients that they don't come to their appointments. And it's so frustrating because it's like, we want to help you. And then all that's going to happen, if you don't come to a certain number of appointments, you know, back to back, we have to discharge you. And then the process starts all over again. And it's time wasted. It's resource wasted, doctor's time wasted, nurse's time wasted, and your time wasted. And on top of which, what's, you know, worse is your health is deteriorating. I mean, the whole process is really frustrating, but I mean, I don't know what we could really do apart from push someone through the door and say, come now. Like,
yeah, well, it's these challenges that you have to be aware of in your role, in the same way my mum, who's a clinical pharmacologist, has a lot of issues with patients that aren't taking their drugs. Yeah. And that's her specialty. She knows the drugs work, but if you're not taking them, she can't help you. So one of the things we've noticed time and time again on the podcast is that a lot of the guests who have lived experience of mental illness have to get to some kind of breaking point before they get the support. And particularly that seems to crop up a lot in addiction, things like alcoholism that we've mentioned. Is that something that you see quite a lot in your practice as well?
The first step is actually recognizing the signs yourself and actually admitting it. And actually, that's the hardest step. It's very rare I find a patient that says, I've noticed I've had symptoms of anxiety, I need help, and you will get the help. There's no doubt about it. But what happens is people ignore it. They blame something else, whatever it might be. They might blame a dynamic with the mum or the dad or a relationship. They might turn to alcohol and blame that. They might blame the job, but they will never face the issue themselves. And it's not about blaming yourself. It's about, this is what's going on and you have to face it. It's just like, I always compare it to, if you know you're getting pain in your chest and you keep ignoring it, you'll get the heart attack. And you could have then right away, well, this first time you got the pain, gone and seek help. It's the same thing. Just like if you find a lump on your breast, you ignore it to a point where you've got breast cancer. It's the same with mental health. You keep ignoring it, you'll get to the point where it's the most extreme form at the end. And then you have no choice but to then come in under sort of an emergency. And that's not the only time you can get help. Just as if you find a lump on your body, you go to your GP and then it will be taken from there. GPs actually do, I think it's between 40 to 70% all mental health patients. And they contain that until it gets to a point where they need help from advanced services such as myself in the hospital. So I don't agree with that, but that's how people perceive it, because they don't want to sort of admit that they didn't get the help when the signs were there.
Right, that's interesting. I guess I can think of situations where it's a combination of the two, that they resisted those symptoms and they found ways to explain them away. And I feel like often that can be linked pretty directly back to the stigma. That we try and rationalize it as anything but mental illness because it's so feared and it's so misunderstood. Would you agree?
Yeah, no, I think people are scared. I mean, you know, you're not, I always think about it like this, like you're not so scared if you tell someone you have asthma, but the moment you say, I've got schizophrenia, people shudder. They're so terrified of it. And I understand why, you know, people are afraid. We don't understand what it is. And, you know, I was telling someone, I mean, I go traveling a lot. So in parts of India, they still chain people up naked on a tree if they've got mental health problems because they don't understand. This schizophrenia, for example, and this medication or psychology work is available. And it's all about stigma. And there's this, especially in Asian culture, I've noticed, just because, you know, my family are Asian, they hush it all up. They're ashamed of it. They don't want to say it. So I know someone who is married to someone who's got schizophrenia, and they're embarrassed of it. And it's because you feel judged. You feel like people look at you differently. They're scared of you. You know, your boss might look at you differently. You might not have friends. People are scared of it. But it's all about education. And honestly, I'm really positive. I think in 50 years, I think this will be so, like, we'll look back. I can't believe people were talking about stigma of mental health, but people are afraid. And I think I understand that.
Yeah, definitely. I agree. The change is coming and you really feel it. But there's still so much to go. And it's really unfortunate to hear, particularly when you give examples of other countries, that as much as we're progressing, there's so many places that are quite far behind.
Yeah, no, I just want to mention with that. So I've mentioned it before to somebody. So when I went traveling Peru, they took us on this day trip. So we did like volunteer medical clinics in the jungle. It was an incredible experience. Wow. But we went for one day and it was almost like a wasteland. If you imagine like tumbleweed, you know, blowing past, it was so empty. I didn't know where we were. You just didn't see anything. But what we did see was sort of, it looked like an abandoned prison with just cells like scattered all across this like desert land. It was so bizarre. It felt like the apocalypse. And when you went up to sort of one of the cells and imagine it's all broken, you know, battered down because there's only one cell here and there miles around. I remember walking up to it and there was a person behind it and they were locked in there. And I was reaching my hand out to touch their hand and then someone pulled me away and they said, no, 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 dangerous. And then they put food in almost like a doggy bowl and slipped it under the cell. And then I realized, because I didn't know where we were at that point, I realized this is their psychiatry hospital.
Oh, wow.
And it was so barbaric. And I just thought, this is just, I mean, it's almost insanity itself. And they were bathing these human beings with lake water, you know, pouring it over them with their clothes on and just staying away from them, doing it over the top of the cell. And I just thought, I can't believe people are still living like this. It's just so barbaric. It's so, you just don't think it ever happens. And, you know, when I think of that, I think we're so lucky, actually. I mean, we complain so much about services, but we are such in a privileged, like, existence in the Western world. People are living with honestly nothing and they're treated like animals. They quite literally are, and I've seen it. And when you see that, you're just really taken aback because those countries and those individuals, they have another 1,000 years to go the way they're going. So that's why I always look at the positive. Like, yes, we are still fighting this, but actually we're much closer than other places.
So I really love that perspective. And that's something I really try and push on the podcast as well, that there is always hope and that we are so lucky in this country with the kind of support that we have here. So no matter what mental illness you're dealing with, it's always manageable. And to continue along the theme of comparisons with different places, and one of my favourite statistics from the British Medical Journal is that in the US, the government spend more per person on providing medical support than we do in this country, despite the fact that people have to pay for insurance there and our NHS is free. And so even compared, we're doing pretty well. And I think that's something to, I'm sure you're very proud to be a part of.
I always say if I ever have kids one day or grandkids, I'm going to be so proud to say, you know, whether the NHS is there or not, and I hope it is, that I was part of it. Because I think it's such an amazing system and I'm so grateful. I mean, for me, when I think of, you know, I'm born in this country, my parents were, I just think it's an amazing opportunity and I'm so grateful that I was part of it. It's an honour, actually. Like, we complain so much, but it's a privilege. And, you know, I hope one day if it does go, I hope that everyone will look back and say, wow, we were very lucky as a country to have the NHS and what it stands for.
Yeah, absolutely. We really are. And so I just wanted to come back to one other thing you mentioned there about Peru and about the squalor people were living in. I don't even want to call them patients because they don't sound like any treatment of patients I know. And it makes me think, how can people ever be cured in that scenario? You know, not all mental illness is curable, but how can you be helped? some of these stories I hear, and even from guests I speak to in this country, where they've gone through experiences so bad in their own mental illness and in their own life, you think, well, of course you were ill.
You know, it's obvious. I mean, I feel even guilty even saying that, because I feel like I'm not doing anything, but I just feel like bad, because what can I do? And unfortunately, in these developing kind of countries, it leans, because you have to have money in these places. And if you don't, and most of the individuals don't, like most of the population are, I mean, I've seen it, that they live on trash, their homes are made of, their floor was compressed trash, like that is their floor. It was disgusting. Everyone lives in one room. They have absolutely nothing. The clothes they wear are those literally that we give them as tourists when we were over there. And some people preferred clothes rather than money, because that's what they actually need. Their children need clothes. They had holes all over the place. Their genitalia were showing. And they can't do anything unless, you know, they have some sort of in. And I mean that they know somebody who is in that private sector there, which is unlikely, you know, charity work. And how likely are you to get a charity, you know, organization that's able to fund everyone in that all the locations? You can't. Or you travel to another country. So when I was in Nepal, actually, I had this woman. I don't even know how she did it. She was as old as my grandmother. She trekked all the way from India on foot, all the way to Nepal, to this one hospital she had heard of, which I happened to be volunteering at, because she knew she'd be able to get the treatment there. But I mean, how, you know, how can you do that? You know, people are suffering. And I don't know the answer. And unfortunately, if their own government doesn't actually put the money back into the country, I don't know. I feel awful for these individuals. I don't know what they're going to do, because you can't do so much on charity.
Yeah, absolutely. And I feel like in a way, as much as these experiences vary so widely depending on the socioeconomics of the country, it's all part of a universal bigger problem, because I think whatever country you're in, stigma can be really convenient. Pretending mental illness doesn't exist, or that locking people away helps, is convenient. It's economical, or encouraging stigma through government and medical decisions works, because then less people feel comfortable coming forward with those problems. Like, there's a clear economic advantage to stigma. And so it is a privilege in many ways that we live in a first world country. We have the wonderful NHS, that we can fight this kind of stigma, and the support is there. That's the scary thing, that as much as that's a universal problem, some of the places you described, there's not even the support. Even if people do have more understanding, the support is so much further away.
Yeah, no, it is. And I remember, you know, really simple things, like going back to Peru, a woman, she was pregnant and she needed a C-section. And we don't even think twice in this country. You get to see the obstetrician, you know, you get all these appointments booked. I think sometimes, why are you having all these appointments just for someone to feel your stomach or whatever? And, you know, this woman died because they didn't have an obstetrician there. They didn't have anything. You know, she was in the middle of the jungle. She couldn't be airlifted out. And all they had was sort of a really sharp weapon they had made out of wood. Mm-hmm. And they tried to actually cut and do a C-section like that through this wood. Oh. And obviously she died. And, you know, when you think about these things, and I don't want people to think, oh, you know, I feel bad for, what, you know, living this life. But we do sometimes need to take a step back and think, you know what, we do have the help. We're very lucky. There's so much we can do for ourselves. We're lucky. When a doctor says to you, look at your diet and exercise, you can go to the gym. You can afford that. You can go get food. Some people don't even have the privilege just to be able to walk to get food. You know, there's so much that we can do. And I think that's incredible. And we need to not forget that we are so powerful. I mean, if you're listening to a podcast, I mean, you're in a privileged position already that you can even listen to a podcast. I mean, you know, we have so much, and we can be the best version of ourselves, but we can do so much on our own. And that's one thing I always say with my patients. I don't like giving patients medication, just as if they have diabetes. I don't want them to have medication, because there's so much we can do on our own. And I think putting that power back in somebody is amazing, because it's scary for some people, because sometimes you want to get a magic wand and just be like, oh, you know, this is going on, so I just put a plaster over it, you know, metaphorically speaking. But actually, if we just take a bit of control of ourselves, there's a lot we can do ourselves. And that's with any health problem, mental health or physical. You know, look at what you're eating, look at what you're doing, look at the triggers, look at the stresses, look at your lifestyle. Don't do what other people tell you to do. Adapt it to yourself. I'm dyslexic. you know, I have to adapt the way I work in order to be the best possible doctor I can be. Mm-hmm. That hasn't stopped me one bit. Having mental health problems shouldn't stop you. Just as if you have a wheelchair, you work around it. You take the lift. You don't take the stairs. You know, you adapt to it and you can still do what you want to do. And I always say medication should always be the last resort because, you know, that's not the end all answer as well. But there's I say about 70% you can do on your own. And I think that's a powerful position to be in. And I think we need to take advantage of that.
Yeah, absolutely. And again, that speaks to the privilege of the options we have in this country, that medication is rarely the only option. And even in the most severe cases of mental illness, I can't really think of any personal examples where medication was the only support somebody got, that actually at its very worst, it's a combination of different types of support that's the most effective.
Yeah. Exactly. I think that's amazing.
And so one thing I'm just keen to pick up on as we're talking about medication, on the flip side, there's this problem of pill shaming, that there can be a lot of stigma specifically on taking medication. It seems to, in my experience, correlate somewhat with how long you're taking the medication for as well, that long-term medication is looked down on more. Is that something you find with your patients, that they come into seeing you with that kind of negative?
Absolutely. And it's funny you say that because I've actually just seen it. So currently today I'm working in a children's clinic. Right. And it's so surprising to me. So one of the mothers is a nurse. And you would think, you know, because we do stereotype. You'd think a nurse, you know, this nurse would know all about the medication. It's ADHD medication, actually, you know, what the benefits are. But she was so anti it. And I just thought, I'm so shocked to hear this. And her son needed it. And it was really difficult because, and it's because she's from an Afro-Caribbean culture. So their culture is very anti-medication and tablets. And I just thought, it all comes really from your childhood, your culture, the way your parents have brought you up and what's been sort of ingrained into you. So if your parents are telling you, you know, medication's bad, you know, you can do this with herbal remedies, you know, this isn't going to be fixed. And I have had parents say this to me. You're going to grow up thinking that and thinking something's wrong with you, rather than you just need this to be stable and long term. And they want a quick fix. They just want it for a few months and that's it. And the moment you say you might have it lifelong, or you might not, but for a few years, you get a lot of negative reaction. I don't think I've had a single patient that's been happy about that. Even with depression or anxiety, people are not happy about it. And unfortunately, that's just your own mindset. So I can't change that unless it's through education. But I think the generation now, you know, children now are much more clued on. I was having a talk with a little five-year-old the other day. It was my friend's daughter. And she was talking about Brexit and the NHS and mental health. And I thought, wow, like I was so taken aback. And I was having a really in-depth conversation with this five-year-old. And I thought, wow, you're more clued on than some of my adult patients about medication and why it would help. And I was so impressed. But I think there's hope for the young generation because, you know, they're learning so much more and they're growing up with this era of mental health at the moment, that wave of everyone knowing, and it's becoming normalized. And I recently did a conference with young people, and Jamie Campbell was there actually as one of the guests. And I was so impressed. You know, I had these 10-year-olds telling me about autism and, you know, ADHD and what it was and why, you know, some of their friends have it and how they can help. And I just thought, wow, this is so impressive. And they completely understood you might have to have medication a long time, and that's fine. But unfortunately, the patient cohort I'm with now, they find it quite distressing because they feel like something's wrong with them. And that's the big battle that we have to face with them. And lots of the reasons why we have patients for so long and they come in and out is because they stop medication and then we have to start over again. And the cycle repeats. And that's really, really hard.
Right. And that is really positive to hear. You're noticing these changes in young people. But it's going to be an ongoing battle. But I think you're right in saying that so much of it comes down to education. Because in many of those examples, whilst parents or even the patients themselves may have been against medication, I doubt they were against like an ibuprofen or a paracetamol.
Yeah, no, exactly. I mean, how many kids do you know have had Calpol, you know, growing up? I mean, everyone has it.
Do you want to hear something silly? I still have Calpol now because I'm not good with pills.
There you go. It tastes really good though, to be honest.
It does.
No, but exactly, there's no stigma to that. But the moment you say something about, you know, mental health medication, I don't know why this fear just strikes over parents eyes and the patient's eyes, and I don't know why. I still don't understand it. I mean, I think it's Michael Phelps. I think he's got ADHD, mm-hmm. and he's been on medication. And I just think, I know I don't like always resorting to celebrities, but I wish more celebrities would come forward, because there's so many that have had mental health problems, and to talk about it and their medication and that it's okay and you're still a normal human being, you know, just as if you had a chest infection or TB or HIV or whatever it might be, that's fine. You just have to take something and that's fine.
And that's something that I've noticed a difference in that you'll probably be able to relate to as well, because I also have dyslexia. And so I've mentioned on the podcast, I've mentioned on the podcast before how growing up, a lot of my role models had dyslexia and they were very open about that. And so it almost felt like a good thing then, like it's some kind of rite of passage that all these business people and artists and creatives that I look up to also have this same feature in them. And yet we're so far behind when it comes to mental illness.
No, it's really interesting to say that. So I can kind of understand sometimes my patients. I was very embarrassed I had dyslexia. I was the only one that had it. I didn't know anyone else that had it. I had to go to special classes. I mean, I'm sure you remember. And I felt really stupid. And I think also I was bullied as well. So people used to see me as stupid as well, because I didn't understand. Because with dyslexia, you have to think a slightly different way in order to kind of understand sort of what, you know, if you're reading something. So I always felt like something was wrong with me. And then it was only, to be honest, it was only until I became a doctor. So it was quite a long time, because I had dyslexia when I found out when I was about 8. And then I was sort of in my mid-20s. And I just thought, you know what? I have dyslexia, but I am great and I've accomplished this. And actually, I think because of it, it's made me almost think in a different way. And I think it, especially now in psychiatry, it makes, especially the young people I speak with, not that I'm trying to be arrogant, but sometimes I mention it to them and they get a glimmer of hope that actually you will be okay. You will still grow up and you still will have arms and legs and have a mind of your own and you'll still be able to live your life. And it's really nice to see, to be someone else's role model. And that's really nice. I never had that. So I'm really glad you had that and it was normalized for you.
That's a really nice, positive place to finish up. We are running out of time now. So is there any kind of last takeaways, anything last you wanted to mention about your role, and then anything you wanted to promote?
Yep. So I'm the secret psychiatrist. It was lovely to speak with you today. And for anyone listening, I just want you to remember, just as with physical health, which is completely normal, so is mental health. So I wish you well.
Brilliant. I love that. Well, thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you for listening. For a list of our recommended resources, visit mentalpodcast.co.uk. And remember, we are in no way a substitute for qualified counselling or other mental health support. Our show is edited and produced by the brilliant Pete Murta, with licensed music by NetSky. Links in the description. Speak to you next Thursday, and remember, you are enough.